Welcome to today's ZKF Public Talk. I'm very happy to welcome Volker Schmidt from the National University of Singapore. Volker asked me to only do a very brief introduction, so I'll keep it very brief. But I have to point out that since we are guests at the Zentrum für Kulturwissenschaftliche Forschung, Volker actually studied cultural science besides sociology and political science. And he earned his PhD from the University of Bremen, habilitation at the University of Mannheim, and then in the year 2000, he joined the Department of Sociology at the National University of Singapore, and he is there now a full professor. He has worked on distributive justice, comparative sociology of the welfare state, and on global modernity. His book on the subject from 2014, A Conceptual Sketch of Global Modernity, is maybe a conceptual precursor to today's topic, which is From Societas to World Society, Genealogy of a Concept. So the Latin word here, societas, or I don't know how to pronounce a Latin word
in English. It seems that in English, and I'm going to try to do that, it is pronounced as societas.
Societas, okay, yeah, that doesn't sound like the Latins
but
would say.
No, I don't think that's the Latin version, but the Latin version, you know, let's just forget that.
Okay, okay.
So we anglicize it.
But the Latin word here shows that this will be a deep drilling exercise in the history of thought, and we're very much looking forward to it.
Thank you very much for the kind introduction. I'm very pleased to be here. And thank you for attending this presentation. Okay, in everyday parlance, no less than in academia, the word society tends to refer to a country, state, or nation state, sometimes also to its resident population, or more commonly, citizenry. It is in this sense that we speak of German society as distinct from French society, of a Japanese society, a Brazilian society, and so on. Different usages may vary in the accent they place on one or another element of this understanding, but they all share a common political grounding. While we may take this for granted, there's nothing self-evident about it, and we all know this. Many of us frequently or occasionally come in contact with other societies, for instance, with a student society or a scientific society of which we are members, or a joint stock society, Aktiengesellschaft, of which we are customers or shareholders. But we rarely note the discrepancy between our awareness of the existence of multiple types of society and our near automatic association of a single type, political society, when hearing the word and contemplating its meaning. In what follows, I will try to shed light on this paradox through a brief reconstruction of the words history and semantic evolution. How old the world society is, where it comes from, and what connotations it might first have possessed is not exactly clear. The current state of linguistic research suggests common word stems in the Indo-Germanic family of languages, which signify friendly interpersonal relations. Etymologically, it probably originated in Latium, a region in what today is central Italy. If the historical records are to be trusted, then the Latin societas was the first concept of society ever to be worked out systematically. Having at some point entered the normative vocabulary of archaic law, the passing of the famous 12 tables, roughly 450 before our time, marks the turning point. The transition from oral transmission of customary norms to their codification in writing. This sets in motion a process whereby a diffuse semantic field gets narrowed and a more specific notion applicable to legally defined societas emerges. The legal societas comes in two main versions, one economic, the other military. The economic variety is believed to have descended from inheritance law, whose details need not concern us here. Over the course of several centuries, it morphed into a consensual contractual partnership. The contracting parties pooled resources for the pursuit of joint commercial interests. Depending on a society's goals and composition, it could be short-lived, put together for a single transaction, and terminated immediately after its completion, or it could be organized as a more long-lasting enterprise that might exist for years or and even decades. Socii could provide different resources, be actively involved in the relevant work, or just be passive investors hoping for a good return on spare money. A special type of economic society was the Societas Publicanarum, formed by publicani, private businessmen, who took up contracts with the Roman political administration for performing tasks the administration was neither willing nor able to carry out on its own. Since many of these tasks involved very capital-intensive projects, they exceeded the means of even the wealthiest families. Interested parties thus formed a societas whose lead investor made the contract with the magistrate in charge. While most commercial societades were regulated by private law, their military counterparts fell under public law and the law of peoples, Völkerrecht. And while the societas Publicanarum, despite possessing certain features that likened them to agentic collectives, ultimately remained association among separate individuals, military societades were relationships between corporate actors, the Roman civitas or populus with other non-Roman civitatis or populi. Civitas is what we today would translate as state. Their establishment could be limited to a single campaign, after whose completion they got dissolved, or they could be thought of as durable, lasting indefinitely. Different provisions regulated the arrangement between the socii. What all such treaties had in common was that the partners were obliged to come to each other's aid when called upon, supply troops and other resources needed for warfare against a foe, and stay true to the contract. As in the case of a commercial partnership, breach of trust ended the societas. The formation of a societas typically followed the capitulation of a polity's authorities to the commanding offer of a Roman legion attacking it. Through capitulating, the affected population put its fate unconditionally in the hands of the victors. Before the societas could be established, the defeated side needed to be reinstated in its freedom of self-governance, that is to say, its pre-war status as an independent polity. Both the capitulation and the creation of a societas that might follow it were based on the premise that the parties concluding them possessed the sovereign power to make the pact. To be legally binding, either party had to voluntarily commit itself to the conditions stipulated in the agreement. Since loss of sovereignty upon capitulation made that impossible, the victor had to unilaterally revoke it prior to forming associates with the future ally. Entering into an alliance with Rome transformed the erstwhile enemy into a Roman socius and conferred it the status of a federated polity. That the compact with Rome was an unequal one made no difference. Given its nominal autonomy, the inferior party was presumed to have been at liberty of consenting to Rome's superiority without coercion. De facto, the result was a one-sided dependency. 19th century historian Theodor Mommsen therefore called the military societas a contract of submission. Others speak of a patron-client relationship. The societas that became the social sciences standard, or as I prefer to call it, default model of society, has a different background and made its first appearance as the societas civilis. The name leaves no doubt about the type of society it was, a political society. Societas civilis is the Latin translation of the Greek phrase koinonia politike. Koinonia is mostly translated as communitas or societas, terms which have been used interchangeably for two millennia, and political community or society refers to the communitas societas of civis from polites, the citizen. So being a society of citizens, civil society was from the start a society of political beings. Its objective was the building and maintenance of the polis, a fortified urban center surrounded by a rural hinterland and ruled by the civitas. The political organization, literally assembly, of the city's citizenry. With reference to the center, rule means self-governance by the citizens. In relation to the periphery, it means domination, rule over. In the Roman case, the center was the city of Rome, its periphery after centuries of expansion being the huge territory over which the civitas had come to wield power. The city's, and by implication the empire's, governance was shaped by a set of institutions which constituted its politeia, the public order or res publica, set up by the society of citizens. The res publica is not to be confused with a republic, but could take on any form, any known political form. The advocate, politician, and publicist Marcus Tullius Cicero defines it as follows. The res publica belongs to the people. The people is not a group of human beings congregated in any sort of way, but a multitude united in an agreement about just laws for the common good. If the res publica is the res populi, the people's thing, that's the literal translation of res, then who are the people? The people are the citizens, but far from everyone residing in the city qualifies for citizenship. Categorically excluded are slaves, women, children, and foreigners, all of whom lack the requisite attributes. Freedom in the case of slaves, cognitive and physical strength in the case of women, maturity in the case of children, trustworthiness and or military service in the case of foreigners. Freedom as a precondition of citizenship, which qualifies for co-ownership of the res publica, hence also for membership of political society, strongly reverberates with the eligibility criteria for admission into a commercial or military societas. Other parallels include the consent required for making the compact binding on all, the coordination effect channeling a large number of individuals into collective action, and the shared benefits which the participants, the partners, also CI, can expect to reap from their political cooperation. These contractualist echoes, notwithstanding, the societas civilis also contains features which put it on a very different footing. First, interest rational calculations are not the most important driving forces behind its emergence. Human beings join in society not to overcome some perceived weakness of a generally preferred solitary life, but because of their innate sociality, which naturally disposes them to seek the fellowship of others, quite independent of its instrumental value. Second, while commercial and military societies are nothing more than flexible tools that can be discarded without regret once they have served their mission, civil society is an object of deep affection and adoration that ought therefore, thirdly, to be sustained for the long term, if not in perpetuity. Put differently, the former are a means to an end, the latter is an end in itself, an end so precious that the responsible citizen must be willing to give his life, to sacrifice himself for it if need be. What makes it this special? The fact that its stakeholders owe so much to it. People are what they are because of what they receive from society, from the ties that connect them in different degrees of intensity and mutuality with their fellow socii, and of all the society they may form or be parts of, from family via kinship networks to the entirety of the human species, none is dearer to them, none more important, and with none are they joined by firmer ties than the city, the commune, the res publica, the fatherland, in short, the societas civilis. So much for political society as portrayed by Cicero, who closely follows Plato's and Aristotle's reasoning. Comparing it with the commercial and military societies begets two fundamentally different types of society, one constituting a purely instrumental relationship established for attaining specific goals requiring limited cooperation among self-interested parties, the other a corporate whole composed of different parts whose totality constitutes a unitary body that has its purpose in itself and completely absorbs its members. Both types survived the downfall of the Roman Empire. The economic society played a key role in the medieval commercial revolution. The military society in the defense of central and northern Italy's affluent city republics against German invaders, but also against neighboring or papal forces in struggles over control of a particular region. What then of the societas civilis? It survived as well. The term continued to be the idiom of choice for medieval political society's self-description, quite independent of the form of government it adopted. But now its citizenry increasingly subdivided into further societates, sub-societies, as it were. With the proliferation of self-governing city communes from around the first half of the 11th century, the political field opened up for new forms of participation, contestation, and coalition building, and amongst the lead players occupying it were different societies. The most prominent case of a conflict between societies was that between the societas militum and the societas populi, which played out differently in different locations, but appears to have been a widespread, if not universal, phenomenon. The societas militum was composed of rural landlords living in the city, plus the city's wealthiest magnates, together making up the urban nobilitas or patriciate. They initially exercised full control of the city's magistrate, whose offices they distributed among themselves. The societas populi were the organized populi, the populus. They encompassed many, but far from all, commoners residing in the city, economically independent, propertied citizens willing and able to discharge fiscal and military duties. With the rise of the commercial economy, they demanded more political say and access to the preeminent magisterial offices, which they gradually wrested from the ruling aristocracy until they themselves temporarily became the chief political force in numerous city republics. Yet another layer of sociedades sprang from the requirement for all citizens, essentially the heads of family households running their own smaller or larger businesses and professionals such as jurists or physicians, to enroll in occupation or craft-based guilds, which represented different segments of the commoners' population in the assemblies. Many of them called themselves societies. These lower level societies operated under the umbrella of political society, which since the Renaissance slowly began to take up the title of lo Stato, the state. An example would be Florence. But it took a while before the term would finally prevail. 18th century intellectual discourse still prefers the accustomed societas civilis, but more and more vernacularizes it. In English, it becomes, from around the 17th century, civil society. It would take until the 19th century before the word state replaced civil society for what in any case remained a political society, except that it now widely ceased being called a society. Having for over 2,000 years stood for the society in secular political theory, in the 19th century, a competitor which had begun to assert its autonomy since the 18th century openly challenged political society's centrality, economic society, also known as industrial or capitalist society. Capitalist society is Marx's expression for Adam Smith's commercial society, which Hegel translated into German as bürgerliche Gesellschaft. Prior to Hegel, bürgerliche Gesellschaft had been the German word for societas civilis. This bürgerliche Gesellschaft referenced political society. In Kant's Foundations of the Metaphysics of Morals from 1785, the words society, societas civilis, and state are interchangeable synonyms. Hegel changes that. His philosophy of right, which appears one generation later, transforms bürgerliche Gesellschaft into a purely economic entity, the system of needs, as he pejoratively names it in the classicist borrowing from Plato. The state remains the organized political system, but no longer constitutes a society in his theory architecture, which places what is about to become society plain and simple between the state and the family, thus seemingly demoting society. Hegel achieves this effect with a semantic trick. Aristotle had distinguished three societies: the family, the village, and the city. The city is the polis, a community of free male aristocrats governing themselves, as mentioned before. The citizen's freedom is a function of economic independence deriving from their status as heads of households over which they preside as oikos despots. The household, being institutionally separated from civil society, is their private sphere. It provides for the physical needs of its members relative to their position in the oikos hierarchy, whose head is set free from material production a task suitable only for and duly performed by his slaves. This enables him to devote himself to serving the common good in varying political capacities. Hegel's tripartite division of social order replicates this logic and adapts it to the modern world, seeking to resurrect the old hierarchy in new garb. But there was a problem. The 18th century full-scale breakthrough of capitalism marginalized the household economy. This had two aspects. One, most economic activity moved out of the household, and two, it set in motion a process of permanent economic growth which upset the medieval hierarchy between the aristocracies of sword and purse, the power of violence over the power of money, by making the former increasingly dependent on the latter. Hegel realized this but wanted to keep the ascending bourgeoisie and the economic sphere it controlled in check. His trick was to divest politics of all societal connotations, reserving the title of society for the economy, and then placing this depoliticized society between state and family. Reflecting the new realities, his economy come society gets promoted from the bottom it had occupied in Aristotle and his followers to an intermediate place while cementing politics' centrality. The state or politics and society binary, which has since Hegel been a mainstay of social theory, mirrors this trick. Everything stays the same as in the past, but the language in which it gets described has been changed. In playing this trick, Hegel also positions himself against Rousseau. Rousseau had split the free propertied inhabitant of the city, the burgher, analytically up into an economic bourgeois and a political citoyen. In this latter capacity, the burgher, a commoner, was to look after the common good, which prior to the French Revolution, to whose ideation or preparation Rousseau contributed, had been the preserved of the premier and deuxième état, the clergy and the nobility. Like many of his conservative contemporaries, the after effect of the French Revolution terrified the monarchist Hegel. So as far as he was concerned, the bourgeois had better stay in his proper sphere and leave politics to his natural superiors. The young Marx, aware of Hegel's reservations against the political emancipation of the commercial class, appropriately paraphrased Hegel's bürgerliche Gesellschaft as bourgeois society, not civil society, the preferred designation in English translations of the philosophy of right, which signaled the very political society Hegel wanted to bury. Once he believed to have fully understood its modus operandum, the mature Marx switched to the label capitalist society. On top of this, he took the far more drastic step of upending the age-old hierarchy between politics and economy by postulating the latter's primacy over the former. In Marx's writings, politics becomes epiphenomenal to the economy, which he claims had always been preeminent. This, however, was ideologically camouflaged under the reign of priests and warriors so as to better exploit the producers of surplus value upon whom they parasitically preyed. One of Marx's most significant effects on social theory was to keep 100 years or more of scholarship busy in a controversy over what is owed epistemic primacy, politics or economy. This conflict was diffused by Talcott Parsons, who reduced both spheres to subsystems of the one society he alone was willing to recognize as a society, the nation state. With Parsons, both politics and economy cease to be societies of their own. Instead, they become social systems. The nation state, too, is a social system. But it is the only social system that also qualifies as a society. The distinction between many social systems and a single society was to become overwhelmingly influential. Its importance can hardly be overstated. It ended a long-standing intellectual history during which several types of society had coexisted in theory and practice. Following Parsons' intervention, this was over. And while subsequently rejecting much of Parsons' thought, in this respect, even his fiercest critics became his faithful disciples. They just failed to note this because once methodological nationalism had prevailed, a kind of collective dementia set in which instantly erased all memory of any societies other than political society. We have now reached the point with which I opened my talk. Parsons' construction appears radically novel, but actually just reformulates established Aristotelian premises, which he translates into systems theoretical language. In the Aristotelian conception, political society appears twice, as a whole encompassing different parts, and as that whole's leading part or organ. Parsons' theory adapts this conception to modern circumstances. For his national society is, of course, a political society, just as the polis had been. And the polity, Parsons' name for political system, is easily recognizable as the politeia or civitas, the governing body of the ancients, societas civilis, that upholds the existing order. The ancients and virtually all European scholarship that came after them construed society in the image of the human body, an organic whole made up of many parts whose aggregate constitutes a natural unity. Just as the organic body is composed of multiple organs and limbs, each performing different functions, so the social body has different members from membra corporis, body parts, who likewise perform different functions. Some of these functions are of a higher, others of a lower order, but all are necessary for the whole's integrity, depend upon each other, and cannot exist without the other. They consequently share an interest in the well-being, the common good, of the whole. The better coordinated the parts, the greater the well-being attainable for all. And when the body social is understood as a polity, then it becomes a body politic. In the body politic, the head symbolizes the commanding part, government, that integrates the actions of the whole by giving direction to the parts. The transition to modernity involves two changes of great importance to our topic. One referring to the common good, the other concerning the structure of society whose complexity increases enormously. Beginning with the former, when Cicero said the societas civilis belongs to the people whose good it was to serve, unlike today, the people did not mean everyone, but only a select few, as already indicated. This did not change much until the French Revolution, which inaugurated the notion's generalization to a country's entire adult population under the rallying call for full political rights for the tiers état, the third estate. Prior to that, the common good meant protection of the interests of the ruling class, packaged as the good of the people, whose large majority, filthy plebeians in the Roman case, savage peasants and parvenus in the French case, were looked down upon and excluded. Substantively, it meant keeping the internal and external peace. through upholding the law, a law that benefited the elites politically as well as economically by institutionalizing privilege. Complexification of the structure of society occurs through the differentiation of systems specializing in particular functions. In the Parsonian model of the national society, which to him, in an explicit reference to Aristotle, is relatively the most self-sufficient type of social system, differentiation is an internal affair, as indeed is most societal traffic. It gives rise to the emergence of national religion systems. In Europe, this takes the form of a system of national churches. The national science systems, national economies, national education systems, national health systems, national legal systems, and last not least, national political systems. The latter are to ensure these partial systems, Teilsysteme, coordination so that the total society, Gesamtsociety, or societal collectivity, as Parsons also calls it, can act effectively as a unit in unison. Governmental agencies establish and enforce normative aura within a territorial area whose preservation is a fundamental imperative, because without a territory, no society can survive. It is easy to see how this construct duplicates the ancient whole, including its obsession with oneness and harmony in the face of constant strife and discord, which it covers up rhetorically. The latest wave of globalization from around the turn to the 1980s cast doubt on the tenability of the Parsonian equation of nation-state and society. His conception of society visualized society, to use Ulrich Beck's apt metaphor, as a closed container, with the political system controlling both its internal processes and inflows and outflows. Globalization exposed this imaginary as illusory. The container's walls, the nation state's borders, proved to be anything but waterproof. So permeable were they that it became increasingly difficult to demarcate the nation, the national from the non-national, extranational, transnational. This is not the place for diving deeply into the literature on globalization. Suffice it to say that much of this literature is still under the spell of methodological nationalism, asking questions about the nation state's fate and frequently reasserting its practical as well as social scientific centrality. This changes with the arrival of Niklas Luhmann on the scene. Partly under the impression of globalizing trends, he postulates the need for a radically new beginning in social theory. The result of a lifelong commitment to this goal is a theory of society which finally breaks with the old European legacy. In lieu of a multitude of national society, this theory gives us a single world society composed of globe-spanning communicative operations that reach into the planet's remotest corners. As in Parsons, this society is differentiated into subsystems performing different functions, but their totality does not add up to a whole of which they are mutually cooperating parts. Instead, they each pursue their own reference problems, follow distinct self-referential operation logics, rather than being oriented to the needs or performing tasks of on behalf of entities other than themselves. Nor is there any agent capable of committing them to some higher cause, such as the common good of old. Modern society, says Luhmann, is a society without an apex or a center. Several systems may vie for primacy, but social theory, while observing their competing claims, cannot hierarchize them, fit them into a transitive order that settles the matter once and for all. Luhmann does not downplay the political system's importance. He is well aware of the enormous growth of political functions and administrations which have intervened into ever more spheres and aspects of life over the past two centuries or so. But he removes it from the throne it had occupied for nearly 2,500 years of theorizing, during which social theory was near coterminous with political theory. Not only does he reduce it to one of many social systems, he also portrays it in a much more sobering language. Reading earlier theorists through a Luhmannian list, what could be called a specifically German tradition of modern social theory, differing substantially from a French tradition culminating in Durkheim and an Anglophone tradition culminating in Parsons, emerges on the horizon. This tradition, which arguably begins with Marx, never quite subscribed to the old European orthodoxy for which the nation-state is the natural successor of the societas civilis. It can therefore be viewed as preparing the ground for the Luhmannian alternative. Marx departs from orthodoxy in two fundamental respects. First, as already mentioned, building on Hegel, he switches from a political to an economic conceptualization of society. And second, his analysis of the process of capital accumulation, characteristic of the modern economy, anticipates what in Luhmann becomes the autopoietic self-creation of social systems, reproducing themselves in processes of recursive closure against the environment. Luhmann goes beyond Marx in generalizing this logic across all social systems, but Marx offers the best illustration of the workings of an autopoietic, self-referential system prior to the terms coinage by Maturana. Next in line is Tönnies, who portrays society as essentially a Roman commercial society writ large, and the contract that serves as its key constitutive element as a highly divisive force, a device which turns society in what Polanyi would half a century later call a satanic mill, anything but harmoniously integrated. Weber likewise rejects the organicist whole parts metaphoric, and while not, as some recent Weberians have argued, shedding the concept of society altogether, adopts it without reservations only for businesses understood as modern variations of the Roman societas. Simmel finally de-essentializes society with his processual concept of societalization, Vergesellschaftung, which had already played an important role in Marx. In Weber's soziologische Grundbegriffe, it would come to assume the position that society occupies in Durkheim's oeuvre. Moreover, contrasting it with communalization, Vergemeinschaftung, which in keeping with Tönnies carries strongly effectual overtones, societalization establishes relations that are primarily instrumentally oriented. How much this background influenced Luhmann's conception of society is hard to say. It is, however, easy to see that it offers building blocks which can be fitted into this conceptualization. I come to my conclusion. Luhmann's theory of world society meets with considerable resistance in the social sciences. It has been able to garner some attention and influence in the German-speaking world of continental Europe and its immediate neighborhood, but it is virtually unheard of, let alone seriously engaged with in Anglophone academia, which, as far as the world's social science is concerned, virtually is social science, not least because its textbooks set the agenda for what is globally taught as social science. The main objection brought against the theory is the familiar truism that the world is not or does not have a state, and that in the old European tradition, which in the aftermath of World War II became the idiom in which the whole describes itself, seals the matter. No state, no society. Assuming one has reason to believe that this idiom is misleading because it reflects the condition of a society which no longer exists, it's Luhmann once said, then this is unfortunate. But what might account for the tenacity of a paradigm whose obsolescence appears evident to Luhmann's followers, myself included? One answer that suggests itself is a variation of the Brodelian notion of the longue durée. Old habits die hard. Political society, of which the nation state is just the most recent manifestation, has been with us for such a long time that letting go of it is a tall order. No wonder it is resolutely held on to. Abandoning it destroys the certainties that come with it, and that creates anxiety, especially when the formation of a compelling alternative is still in its early stages. Thank you very much for your attention.